Welcome back to Walking Away from Arcadia. This is Simon, and today we're going to be talking about politics. We're going to be talking about World of Darkness and its sort of basis in social commentary and satire and parody, and how that affects the design and story in Changeling, and how maybe it doesn't affect those things. So, if you've had enough of real world news and politics and world events, you might want to skip this episode.
So, full disclaimer, we've been talking about doing this episode for a while, and we know that not everyone plays Changeling, right? Not everyone plays the World of Darkness with social satire in mind, and certainly lots of people do not play Changeling that way. A lot of people want to pick up their kith and go questing into the Dreaming, and that is a perfectly legit way to play the game. But we were both thinking a lot about the fact that we've heard designers from World of Darkness, especially back in the day, comment on the fact that the game was originally designed to satirize, make fun of, make social commentary on events of the day. Martin Elrickson, the current lead storyteller for White Wolf, has said that's when he thinks the game is best. I've heard Phil Brocato in interviews talk about this. So, I think it's most obvious in Werewolf and Mage. Freak Legions is certainly rife with social statement. Guide to Pentex is dripping with it. Mage is full of it. Vampire and Wraith have a little less. And then there's Changeling. And man, Changeling and social commentary is really interesting. It's not really there a lot in the early books. It kind of creeps in here and there. There are definitely parts of C20 that are just very straightforward about we're making social commentary. We've talked a little bit on previous episodes about how we don't think they always hit the mark, but they certainly attempted it. And in some cases, they hit the mark. The later books, I feel like, had a fair bit of social commentary. Fool's Luck, Way of the Commoner, and War and Concordia stand out in my mind. I don't know, Simon, would you agree with that?
Fool's Luck, War and Concordia. Sometimes the She books hit that, but they mostly didn't. And The Enchanted is a big one for me, because The Enchanted set out a lot of the mortal organizations that interact with the Fae, but maybe they don't know they're interacting with the Fae. And I remember especially, there was a Facebook post ages ago where Phil Brocato just came out and said, "Look, I worked on some of this project, and you want to talk about where the Autumn People came from? Let's take a look at Scared Straight and Dare and these other programs."
Yeah, and I feel comfortable sharing this because Phil Brocato has written about it rather extensively and publicly, but he has a really ugly history with some of those "we're going to make you better" programs. He hasn't written about going through them, but he's written about, individuals in his life that he cared about very dearly going through them. I don't want to necessarily paraphrase. If you are interested, you can find his blog pretty easily in a Google search, and I will let his public word speak for himself, but they are ugly posts, and they're very rooted in some of the initial concepts in Changeling. And that,
Yeah.
and
And
yeah, it.
just for context, to make the Google search easier, I think the most relevant one is Cat's Story, Cat with a K.
Yeah, it's a hard read, and I
Yeah,
guess
it
it.
reminded me of, oh shoot, there was a journalism piece that got canned but was submitted as a court document, so you can find it online now. Back in the late 90s, I want to say, but it might have been the early 90s, the Westboro Baptists had an expose written about them, and some of the details are very familiar in both stories.
Yeah, and I guess in that respect, that one detail, the Autumn People, the Dauntain to an extent, were I would say social commentary, but then the game was kind of heading that direction and then took a stark left turn into Arthurian shenanigans. You know, anyone who's listened to the podcast knows that Simon and I talk a lot about, we sort of dance around the social commentary issue about how certain things can reflect various aspects of the world. I feel like Changeling is really interesting in that, unlike the other games that are very kind of direct with their social commentary, Vampire's social commentary is kind of personal. Werewolf and Mage's social commentary are very much about corporations in the modern world and how it corrupts us. And it's very, like, you read those books and you know what they are commenting on. There's no ambiguity in Freak Legions or the Syndicate convention book, or even, say, Guide to the Technocracy, which turns the whole technocracy thing on its head and says, hey, I mean, this isn't all bad, guys. Changeling's weird because so much of the social commentary is wrapped up in, all right, well, these are the dreams. These are the subconscious emanations of society. So why is this feudal dream such a big deal? Why is this feudal dream so prevalent in America, where in theory we put feudalism behind us? And that's always been kind of a hanging question in the fandom that kind of gets hand-waved away. Most people engage with it as like earnest modern urban fantasy. There's a sidebar in C20 that just calls it out and says, why is feudalism a thing in modern America where we're democratic? Okay, let's talk about the Second Gilded Age for a second. Is feudalism dead in America, really? And I was really happy to see that direct call out, but it's not a call out I've seen very many people talk about or invoke using in their games.
Apart from the few places where it directly, like, drives into, this is a thing in the real world, please pay attention here, it tends to be kind of oblique about its references to the real world and the things it's trying to call attention to. The she being one of them. There are people who love the she. None of them are in my friend group. And all of my friends look at the she and they go, these are great bad guys, or I hate these guys so much. But none of them go, yeah, you know, that's awesome. Except Seth, I guess. Seth actually, like, legitimately likes the potential for them to be the good guy. But he also kind of realizes that that's out of type for them. And there's this huge, huge rift in the fandom between, like, those two groups. Because you get the people who are like, I love the she. I love them so much. They're so important. And then you get the people who are like, you know what they are, right? But they don't.
Yeah.
It speaks to this, like, this thing that we were talking about when we were talking about doing this episode. We all kind of have our blind spots. And I feel like, at least as a person, I underappreciate that. Like, there are definitely things where I'm a terrible person and I don't realize it. And, like, I hope I start to realize it and I start to deal with it. But we all have our blind spots. And, like, I want to be sympathetic to these people who look at the obvious imperialism, colonialism metaphor behind the she and don't see it. I have a hard time doing that.
I mean, the thing that is hard for me about the she is I have a very hard time separating my rather basic anarchist nature, which I got from my parents, from my feelings about the she, because I have the same feelings about the Order of Hermes and the Ventru and the Tremere, and if I played werewolf, I would have it about the Silver Striders. I mean, I hate all of those groups. I don't hate them in a, I think they shouldn't be there or that they're poorly written. Honestly, they're all perfectly written as a reflection of what they are a representation of and what they're critiquing. And I think the she are actually more nuanced and more interesting than most of the leadership groups, with the possible exception of maybe Hermes. Hermes, there's a lot of nuance and there's a lot going on there, especially if you go back into the Daedalin period. But the she are interesting because when you look at the archetypical good guy she, the Skaha, And they're like, no, we stay behind, and we're commoners, and we love our commoner brethren, and we're not oppressive. And, oh, what did we do during the resurgence? Well, we sided with the Xi, because of course we did. But it's because if everyone just, like, understood, it would be better then. And that's such a, like, that's such a typical response. Like, that is, to me, the definition of that MLK quote about the moderate white person is way worse than the hardcore racist in a lot of ways. And to me, that's the skaha. And it is vitally important that that's there in the game. That needs to be there. Are they a mustache-twirling villain? No, that's what makes them terrible. People want to play paladins.
Yeah. Yeah. And, like, even in D&D, like, I tried playing a paladin, and, like, I went straight into, okay, well, I'm lawful good. Good is secondary there, because I know exactly what good is. But writing for the history episode, we hopefully have aired by now, like, getting into the head of the Autumn Xi I wrote was really weird for me, because I kept coming back to, like, the seductive power of privilege, and I didn't really explore that at all, but it was in the back of my head the whole time. Like, I gave this up for you people, is, like, the thought in the back of his head all the time.
It shows up in a few lines, and I ended up voicing this character. I loved voicing this character because I like him, but I kind of hate him, but I like him. And to me, that's the perfect Xi. Like, sure, everyone loves a good Balorian or a Ileal, you know, horror show. Oh, I'm a Leonin, look at me, you know, prune my evil. Cool, every story needs a couple of those, but the well-intentioned, I want to be a paladin, I'm trying to do the right thing, and I just don't see it. The quote that does it for me, that really sums up the Xi, is it's really hard to realize that you're not in the right when the core basis of reality is telling you you're in the right. But you still might be wrong. Yeah, no, I mean, that's the Xi. The dreaming is telling them, no, you're right. You have a right to rule. You are correct. And it makes it next to impossible for them to turn around and recognize that, no, maybe they screwed some stuff up. But that is such a perfect representation of privilege. You know, the thing that I think is interesting, and I think the space where you could get into legitimate, I'm Xi and I'm not a villain, is inspecting the fact that especially since the internet, especially since there's been a lot more crosstalk and a lot more direct contact culturally between, you know, privileged groups and underprivileged groups, I'm seeing more and more, especially younger white people. I hope I'm among this group, but, you know, I don't like to make assumptions, and I don't want to get into the headspace that I'm doing it right, because then I'm less likely to notice when I'm doing it wrong. But I see people trying to deconstruct that and actually use the power they have to undo the systems that give them that power. It is by no means the norm, but I see it more than I saw it in the 90s when this game was made. And I'd love to see someone build out and inspect the pitfalls of trying to walk that path as an archetype of Xi experience. In terms of playing them the way they're written, I don't really see a lot of that. But I think that's the one space that you could navigate the Xi as not kind of even subversive good guy villains. But man, you have to rip the feudalism apart really hard. By and large, a lot of people get uncomfortable with that, because you can't pull that spaghetti knot without pulling a lot of spaghetti out of the changeling game.
Well, not even the changeling game. Maybe it's uncouth to point it out, but gamer culture is really white and really male. It's getting better. It's getting better, but a lot of us are made uncomfortable by looking too hard at what's behind the Xi.
Yeah, it's true. I think also, you know, there's the directness of the Xi, and it's easy to kind of lean on them as, you know, no, I want them to be paladins. No, they're actually villains. There's just the broader kind of feudal structure in Changeling. And I think there's a lot of social commentary there. It's hard to build into a story, but the whole, why are we like this? Why do humans dream these dreams, especially in America? There are all of these questions. There are all of these sort of Gilded Age equivalents. You know, it gets back to a quote I heard, you know, and I don't know who said this quote. Even if I had a name, it might be apocryphal, but it's the reason that communism never took root in America, or it may have been socialism never took root. I first heard this quote before the last election, is that, you know, the working class, the lower classes in America don't think of themselves as beaten down proletariat. They think of themselves as temporarily embarrassed millionaires. And it's kind of true. Oh, no, they worked for that money. They worked for that. They deserve that because I might be that someday. And if I get there, I want to have all that right. I want to have all that privilege, too. To me, the whole concordant compromise is that. It's not really called out as that. Like, even the description in C20 doesn't really dive into that. But they're like, yeah, you can have a few seats. Good for you. You're on an advisory council. That's nice.
Yeah, uh-huh. I mean, core of that for me is always going to be sovereign, especially with the way C20 moved in with that. And now commoners who have title and status can use sovereign and they're not actively hunted by the Xi, at least as much. That is a seductive, really, really fraught power to be handing out. And, like, the Xi get it. The Xi just have to get it because it's core to them. But what about the commoners who start to learn a few levels of sovereign? Like, even if they can't use it against most Xi, the oppressor, my oppressor dynamic that emerges from that is horrifying and very true to reality.
And the thing I have to say, and I do not know if this was intentional on the part of the C20 writers, but they built a really interesting loophole into sovereign when they give the example of the celebrity chef in his restaurant is lord of his domain, but that influence doesn't carry over elsewhere. That whole, you can't use it on the Xi, well, not most places. Can you trick them into walking into your story where you rule? Does their title mean as much if they do that? I mean, that gets into some very Shaping Combat-esque space, but it sets up something where it is not unreasonable to tell a story about the sorts of commoners that are smart enough, observe enough about the dreaming to start thinking outside of the story. Because the thing that strikes me about Changeling, and this also gets into how hard it is to do the social critique, Changelings are all written as kind of trapped in their story. In that there are all of these things that they could do with the world that's set up that they're never written as doing. Oh, I muse and I ravage to get glamour. You read the systems for that. You could literally design an artist, a politician, a serial killer, and every once in a while there's a, oh, Occupy was inspired by. We're going to walk away from that and do nothing with it. But like there's like one line that will imply, oh, the face sort of inspired this thing, kind of, sort of. But not really. But if you had a changeling that stepped out of that and realized, wait, I'm in the story, but what if I write the story? Suddenly the limitations of the rules become abusable. And Sovereign is very much in that realm with the new C20 framing.
The other thing the C20 framing did, at least for me, I don't think most people would play it this way, but I kind of like the idea of it, is that in context, you may not be the highest thing on the totem pole, even if you are she, but that commoner might be, is it also has this really ugly capacity to reinforce the feudal narrative. A Boggin chef is going to be lord of his domain, but only when he's in that role. It's totally reinforcing the weird class thing that Changeling has going on.
Yeah, it really does. It also, and this is something that I think was a really big missed opportunity in C20, in preparation for this episode, I did a text search on C20 to see if I could find any reference to the Urban Renewal League. Those words do not appear in that order anywhere in the C20 text. At least the Adobe search algorithms tell me so. That is a big hunk of canon.
That is too bad.
Right? That is a big hunk of canon to throw aside. And if you want to paint a complicated relationship between the commoners and the Xi and the noble commoners that really gets into the screwiness of what's going on in our world today and inspects it and says, what is the dream that this is feeding? Or maybe the dream that is feeding all of this. The new sovereign framing intersecting with the Urban Renewal League is an ideal place to start.
The other thing I kind of wish they had done more with, that they, well, legitimately they didn't do much with it in the original run of the game, but they didn't do anything at all with it in C20, is the commoner protectorates, provinces of Concordia, the ones that are ruled by noble commoners, as weird as it is to say that. As much as I hate regional, like, information, I really just wanted there to be a couple of quick, like, flavor stories about commoner rule and what that looks like, and how, after a while, it starts to be indistinguishable from Xi rule, because especially the kind of power that rulership in a feudal system gives you, but also in a lot of American systems, you can't travel the path to power that the leader who you are opposing traveled without becoming more like that leader. It's a tainted well, and it taints the people who draw from the same dirty tricks, the same abuses, in order to get to where they are. They might be nicer to their particular group than the other group, but they're still going to be awful in at least as many ways. The stories about the Xi imposing dross taxes and loyalty oaths, why don't commoner nobles do that in the canon? They totally would.
Yeah, and I think one of the criticisms about C20 from some of the fans that really love the Xi that I actually agreed with, when this gets back to the Urban Renewal League, is C20 kind of pushed home the privilege, rulership, abuse angle on the Xi a little bit. It also introduced the Autumn Xi and softened it for them, and there were certainly some Xi paladin stories in the anthology. It wasn't absolute, but it drove it home a little bit more than the old base books. I had no problem with it because that's what the Xi were, that's what they were in the source books, but like the Urban Renewal League is missing. What it didn't do is paint the very world of darkness before you get ahead of yourself. Nobody's a good guy here. Story. And that's something that I don't want the Xi softened at all. If anything, I think you could be a little more hardline with the privilege angle on the Xi than C20 was. But it needs the counterpoint of, no, the commoners have committed atrocities too. Because that happens. And to what you described, you can't walk that same path. That's very changeling in the way changelings as fae are defined as stories. And if they walk into a story, they sort of become reshaped by the story they put themselves in. That's a very poignant, almost systematic reflection of something that happens in reality that changeling is very well suited to inspect.
You were talking about magic, Janie said. No, I was talking about Gurdjieff. He says there are three levels of consciousness. There is sleeping. He counted them off on his fingers. There is sleeping wakefulness, and then there is awareness. Sleeping is just that. Sleeping wakefulness is when you walk around... He suddenly pointed at Janie's hand, where it had been tapping against her knee. You didn't even realize you were doing that just now, did you? Janie looked down at her hand, which now lay still, and shook her head. That is sleeping wakefulness. We all walk through the world, barely aware of what our bodies do, or what goes on around us. Awareness is when you are informed, utterly aware, of it all. Yourself, and your environment. It's akin to being an avatar, the sort of awareness that a Christ or a Buddha has. For most of us, those moments of true awareness are very rare. They come at high points in our lives, such as the moment before one pronounces one's wedding vows, or just before death. Brief moments of complete awareness that encapsulate everything that we are, in relation to everything around us. Do you understand what I mean? Janie and Claire nodded slowly. Now, imagine that you are always in such a state, to constantly recognize everything for what it truly is, and then to have such absolute control over your will that you aren't capable so much of transforming your surroundings or the wills of those around you, but you can influence them to such an extent that it might as well be considered magic. That, Janie began, that's what the people of this order are like? No, but that's what they strive for. It is their magic. And many of them are, if not fully aware all of the time, at least in such a state, far more than the rest of the world's population. They have acquired great talents, woken gifts that are inherently present in each of us, but they have twisted them to dark purposes and selfish uses. He laid a hand on the stone beside him, stroking its smooth surface with his fingers. I love this world, he added. That is what rules my life. When I die, I want to have done all in my power to leave it in a better state than it was when I found it. At the same time, I know that this can never be. The world has grown so complex that one voice can do little to alter it any longer. It doesn't stop me from doing what I can, but it makes the task hard. The successes are so small, the failures so large, and many. It's like trying to stem a flood with one's bare hands. My quarrel with Madden, Gonanin went on, is that he has the opportunity to make a difference, and yet does nothing with it. His entire life is channeled toward self-gain. You seem to know as much as he does, Janie said. Why didn't you start your own, The Order? I thought of that, Gonanin said, when I was young. But to acquire the position of power that Madden presently holds, I would have had to have become as ruthless as he. And then I would be no better. But if you could make a difference... Gonanin shook his head. I expect that once I reached such a position of influence, I'd no more care for the world than Madden himself. It may sound trite, but using the weapons of the enemy, no matter how good one's intentions, makes one the enemy. Another story that I think Changeling is really well positioned to inspect in a way that Vampire could do, but I don't think I ever saw it do, in a way that Mage could do, but I don't think I ever saw it do, is to look at similarities between feudal loyalty trading and our modern mortgage system and the crises thereof. I'm from Detroit originally. I haven't lived there for over a decade, but I was paying attention when the mortgage crisis hit, and it hit Detroit earlier than maybe anywhere else in the country, but most parts of the country definitely. Watching the way banks shuffled people's mortgages from bank to bank until, you know, normal people couldn't figure out who they were paying their mortgages to and what the terms of the mortgage were and what was even going on with themselves is very, very similar to the way feudal lords passed human beings along and holdings and land and other resources. Changeling is very well positioned to handle that because, one, there's the whole subplot around the coming winter, and she especially, but commoner nobles should be doing this too, forcing loyalty oaths and dross taxes on to their commoner subjects, as well as the inherently legalistic powers that are in Changeling's magic. The power of sovereign, the power of naming, the power of contracts, as well as just the ability to throw oaths around, which is still a little undefined and kind of plot-driven, but more defined than it used to be. And how much worse would the world be if there were just a few supernaturals with that kind of power involved at the edges of the banking system or even in the middle of it?
Yeah, and the thing about that stands out to me, where Changeling is much more well-positioned to inspect that than it used to be. We talked about this a little bit in the second banality and glamour episode, is the new banality framing. I could imagine certainly a Bogart, but even a few Grump Boggins just straight up being part of a lawyer's office or the banking office, you know, okay, I'm immune to environmental banality because I'm a grump. And because of my personal relationship with banality and the fact that I'm a boggin and I don't find these repetitive tasks banal, I can very much see putting boggins or bogarts front and center in these societal institutions, in lawyers' offices, in banks. And I think that some really interesting things emerge and some really interesting synergies with the rest of the world of darkness become very possible. Like, I could absolutely see very legalistic boggins working hand-in-hand with the syndicate. The broad technocracy texts I'll talk about, oh, reality deviants are terrible. You actually get a hold of the syndicate books, and they're like, yeah, yeah, that's the official line. Yeah, we hate reality deviants. Yeah, unless they're useful. Yeah, I mean, vampires, you know, they like to stay hidden, no biggie. I mean, sure, they're, yeah, no, we totally work with vampires. New banality world, I think the same thing would hold true of a lot of Grump Boggins and certainly Bogarts.
And the leadership classes, like Ventru, She, arguably the Black Spirals in New Werewolf, they're a little bit less berserker and a little bit more creeping genius evil, which I like a lot better. And the Silver Fangs, I could see all of them kinda, sorta getting along with the syndicate under the right circumstances, as long as nobody quite realized how much they were being screwed by the arrangement with the other party.
I think that that creates some spaces where you can get a little bit farther into what does glamour mean? What does autumn person mean? I'm about to go pretty deep into some autumn person shenanigans in my game, which I wasn't planning on doing this early in my campaign, but one of my players sort of threw that door open and I shrugged and went, okay, well, I kind of have to walk through it now. And it's compelling. It's exciting. I'm playing with people that haven't played Changeling before, and I'm kind of getting a kick out of the fact that they still shudder every time I say roll a banality trigger. You know, these are changelings that have no temporary banality yet. We're a few sessions in, they're short sessions, you know, and just the idea of one temporary banality still has them shaking. And that creates some spaces where you can really inspect, you know, what scares you and why are you afraid of it? And what does all of this mean? And, oh, you're terrified because of this abusive backstory you put in your character. But what do you do to the people around you? I mean, that's another area that I think has a lot of rich potential for social critique is cycles of abuse, because they're never really called out, but they're all over the place in Changeling.
Even the way they rewrote Slua to not reflect their original story, but to be kind of a boogeyman story. Like, there's a real delicate line between I'm spooky and scary and kind of gross, and I am legitimately terrifying and traumatizing people.
You know, thinking of the Slua as boogeymen, that also kind of gets into something that I think we have to tackle talking about social satire and Changeling, and that is the difference between the more traditional tabletop approach and what By Night Studios is doing with their version of Changeling. You know, to be fair, we've only seen the alpha slice so far. It's very clear they're going kind of a straightforward, here's the story, it's a commentary on the world we live in. Trump being called out as Shadow Court was in our interview with the devs and writers from that game. But it's all very, here's the story, here's what we're saying, here's the social commentary, we're building structures a little bit more like the direct ones in Werewolf and Mage. Go for it. And that's not what Changeling has been historically. Historically, it's, well, what are the courts? The commoners turned them into something during the interregnum. The She came back and changed them, but that old definition's still kind of there. Are the Unseelie evil? Are the Unseelie progressive? What does it mean to be progressive? they're so confusing, which at first approach is incredibly difficult to tackle. But once you kind of grasp the, oh, they're manipulating each other's stories, oh, they're actually crafting this into a cosmological thing, which you have to get into some territory like that only really gets described for what it is in Dark Ages Fae, and then only kind of sorta, and not everyone likes that connection. You know, there's all of this undertow, almost like metaphysical undertow, to the commentary implications in Tabletop that make it really hard to approach for a lot of people. It's a very high bar, high enough that I actually think from a product standpoint, it's not well designed. It's well designed from an art piece standpoint. It doesn't make a very approachable product. I'm curious, Simon, like what you think about the fact that pretty soon we're going to have both of those approaches existing and being developed simultaneously, which we've definitely never had before.
I have a hard time seeing it as anything other than a thing that's going to turn into a split canon. Like, it already is a split canon. And I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. I think the LARP crowd and the Tabletop crowd want fundamentally different things for the most part. I don't say that to take, like, I've got my nose up in the air about one of them, because I really don't. I learned to play World of Darkness with former LARPers, but I have never LARPed myself. And I kind of fundamentally disagree with a lot of the, I think, Tabletop-only perspective, because the Tabletop-only crowd seems to be the crowd that is most interested in playing urban fantasy. But fluffy urban fantasy, or at least high urban fantasy, where I'm much, much more interested in a personal level story that just kind of, you need to engage with the meta plot in order to provide the backdrop to set things off. But one of the things I enjoy about Changeling as a tabletop product is that, and this doesn't speak well of Changeling, but it is that it's so contradictory and messy and kind of poorly coordinated that you can pick the pieces you want to use at any given time and just be like, yeah, this is the thing. I'm golden ruling the other stuff into the background, or like, I'm just going to hope my players didn't read that book. And I'm going with this because it suits my themes better and my interests better. From my particular opinion perspective, like, I like everything I've heard from By Night Studios a little bit better as far as the plot is concerned. It's tighter. It has a focus. Even if I didn't agree with the direction they were going, it's hard to be worse than Changeling Tabletops, I don't know what's going on, and I never did.
This is something I've been thinking about a lot recently, because I've seen several arguments sort of in the social satire sphere of World of Darkness. Not so much in Changeling, this is more other games. And I've been thinking about an argument that I see that comes up a lot that is, oh, well, if you don't like it, just golden rule it. I love and hate the golden rule in equal measure. I love that they put the golden rule in every core book. I love that they invite players to do what they want with the game. I think it's important to encourage people not to be legalistic about, oh, well, this is the way it is. On the flip side, I still want a game where the canon, and the canon can be a bit in quotes, it can be, you know, some games have multiple corners of the canon and you sort of start out and say which corner you're playing in. An example in Changeling is we are playing a fundamentally Cathayne game. We are playing a fundamentally Nunahi game. Like, this is where we're going to center the story. And for someone who knows all the books, that's going to immediately paint a bit of a picture for them. But if you have a canon that either, one, doesn't make sense because it's contradictory, and first edition Changeling is totally different from second edition Changeling, is totally different from what I call the 2.5 edition. It's like once World of Darkness had gone revised and Changeling didn't get a revised, but they also didn't cancel it and they kept releasing books under Art House. I sort of think of that as revised Changeling because the focus did change again. We just didn't get a core book to frame it. You know, when you have something like that, what gets difficult is you say, all right, well, I need to do X, Y, and Z to even get this to a baseline of configuration I want to play. That's a big lift to inform all your characters what their common cultural knowledge is. You know, whenever I hear someone talk about a role-playing game should be meta-agnostic, I think the response to that is, especially for Americans, I want to look at them and say, who would you be without 9/11? Who are you if 9/11 wasn't a thing? Because right. when you go in to create a character, like it doesn't really matter if you're going to use that canon. It matters that everyone knows it happened and has the opportunity to build a character whose lens on the world is informed by it. And you could tweak a couple things and tell your players, but if you look at the game and go, I love this core game, but I just have to gut 30% of the canon, it's a big lift to give all your players their starting gestalt.
Really, role-playing is all about perspective taking, and I can fundamentally disagree with somebody about like what a Kith should be like, but at the end of the day, even like, you know, the core Kith personalities and motivations, they're types. You don't have to play to type. You should be aware enough to know that you're not playing to type and that you're going to have to do some extra lifting as a player to like make it make sense for other people because they're going to be expecting something from you. But some of the best role playing I've done has been against type, and it is exhausting and wonderful.
You know, I think there's a lot of potential to play against type in Changeling, you know, especially when I think about what would happen if, say, the Urban Renewal League, to go back to that as an example, the Urban Renewal League happened, and maybe the reason it isn't mentioned in C20, if you want to run with its absence as meaningful, is David came back and they were able to stop the Urban Renewal League. But part of how they stopped it was by offering a certain amount of clemency. And what happened is it caused the Urban Renewal League to fall apart as a number of people went, oh, holy crap, the king is back. Some people cooperated, and then you have a handful of more hardline members that they don't have the drive anymore. They don't have the dream. They don't have the belief, but they still have the attitude. And you get these two smaller factions. But what happens to the really hardline commoners that used to be totally radical, but now they're learning a little bit of Sovereign? And, oh, I see. Oh, but some of that old attitude, you can't totally get rid of it. They just redirect it, and then it gets aimed at the people beneath them. And then they become very resentful of the members of the Urban Renewal League that didn't give up on that and still believe those things. And that's a cycle that almost always happens when a group of oppressed people become less oppressed. And it's a divide and conquer technique that people in power use, and there is a strong history for it. And the way that would play out with the seductive nature and literal, like, story personality restructuring nature of Fae existence could be really sickeningly awful.
Even in the context of, like, examining a single character, like, taking it out of the groups, because how many people actually use the content from what we probably both think of as the more interesting books? With Remembrance, with even a couple of dots of Remembrance, you have so much time to build a character arc into your character. And what happens if your current life is completely jumping the rails on that one? That'd be so good.
So I wanted to do this story. I had this really sort of twisted, dark story planned in the Dust Bowl that I would love to tell again. But I wanted to pick one of the characters that was Kithane. And I wanted to have the Motley be mixed Nunahi and Kithane and start them out riding the rails. That there's a lot about that time period that lends itself to that being a possibility. And tell a story about what if the Nunahi are a people out of place? Because in that time, you know, you're riding the rails, you're not connected to the land, you can't be. And the Kithane think everything's falling apart because the Dust Bowl. And have one of the Kithane and make sure they have a little bit of Remembrance, have a past life that got into some of the really horrible things that the Kithane did to the Nunahi when they first got here, and make that part of, you know, what the American government did, and make their previous life a part of that. And just slowly, after those relationships are established, start feeding them that Remembrance. and make them deal with that story trying to reassert itself. I have no idea if I could have told that story, and I have no idea if I had any players that would have not just gone, what? But I feel like that's a framework for a story that I really want to work with.
I mean, even in that time period, that's kind of, if I'm remembering right, that's kind of the beginning of the push to relocate Native Americans into cities, too. Yeah?
It isn't. That was a little bit later. Actually, so the Dust Bowl was interesting. I did some research on Native American policy. The Dust Bowl, and right after the Dust Bowl, was actually sort of a rise in Native American autonomy and policies that... It was mixed. I don't want to say they were good. The American government, Native American policy is never actually good. It was better in some ways. That was the period of time when there was a push to like move away from the regional school thing a little bit, or at least the previous version of regional schools. There was a whole nother version that resurged after this period. And sort of push for more Native American autonomy. But there was also a push to make Native Americans citizens that got wrapped up in that. And like some of the policies were great. That policy was sold as awesome and then used as a way to take away sovereign rights because, oh no, you're just a U.S. citizen now. And it was weird. And there were people in the government trying to fight for against that. And then after the Depression... That whole complicated, we're trying to do right by this, but we're not doing a very good job, collapsed. And then you got the heavy push for relocation immediately after that period.
Dang. Never mind then. But like getting a good like Nunahi story that's actually based in the history and the reality of what it is like to have been and to be an Aboriginal person in America is one of the things that Changeling kind of failed at, especially in the social satire commentary column, because they just don't have enough touchstones in the Changeling canon and in the real world history of what happened, where they provided context that lined both of those things up so that people who don't enjoy reading horrific, embarrassing or depressing things about history can pick up and at least pretend they have the context for.
Yeah, well, and the thing is, those touchstones do exist. If you don't look at the canon, if you step back and go, I'm just going to read about history and find these touchstones, the one that blew my mind the most, and again, if you listen to the history episode, this does show up, is the Native American occupation of Alcatraz. Now, Alcatraz is, of course, right off of San Francisco. That occupation was taking place during the first battles of the Concordance War, which happened in San Francisco. That's never a thing that is mentioned in a White Wolf book. I mean, just the number of different stories that emerge from those two things happening simultaneously, the potential there is endless. And that should be, that shouldn't just be a touchstone. That should be like a metaplot pillar. Because of course, especially the thought crafters would be involved in that. Given their goals and what they're all about, they would be involved in that. And no, this whole beginning of the Concordance War in San Francisco at this time, gonna totally ignore that for months and months and months and months, there was a literal occupation happening that would have involved a huge concentration of Nunahi and probably a whole new set of chrysalis because of what that represented culturally and the reawakening of a lot of tradition and a lot of just community around what the Nunahi represent happening at the same place. There's just so much meat there.
And yet, if you don't have a basic familiarity with the real world context around being an Aboriginal American, what do you got?
Yeah, I mean, there's so much additional research that is required. I think one of the other things that gets kind of complicated is, you know, across the world of darkness, and this is just a universal truth in the world of darkness, everybody's the bad guy. at least a little bit. Everybody's a little bit the bad guy. Nobody's good in the world of darkness. But the Nunahi and the Menahune kind of are. Like, I can't find any text on them in any book that really paints the downside of their culture, the downside of what they are. They're never really predatory. Okay, there's a ravaging version of their feeding. I've never seen any text devoted to why the heck they would do it, or seen a story framed around, I mean, the winter court for the Nunahi are not described in terms of they do that thing at all. It's weird. And, you know, when I was starting research for my current chronicle, this isn't a point that I ended up using in the game, but one of the things that I came across, I was researching the Eastern Band of Cherokees because I wanted to include them. It's set in Asheville, North Carolina. And the chief of the Eastern Band Cherokee government had just been impeached for corruption charges. And this all happened within, you know, the tribes. It was entirely their own politics. But when I was just researching what's been going on, you know, politically with the Cherokee in that area to try and figure out if there were any things I could pull in and use in my story, that is what came up. That was like half of the news stories I found because it was such a big deal. That sort of cultural representation of, no, this, they're still human. Humans suck. Don't demonize them. Don't glorify them. That balance is just not there. They kind of end up sterile in a way that in the world of darkness especially is just weird.
There are lots of things about the Nunahi I change in our games. So in northern Minnesota, there's a county called Beltrami County. I lived there for a while, and it has three reservations in it, or three reservations are geographically within it, but they're sovereign states, sort of, because of the weird legal framework around all of that. And one of them is one of two, or possibly the only, surviving closed reservation in the country. It's all of that kind of revolves around whether or not land is held communally or if it's held by individuals, and it's all part of some pretty awful legal history around trying to solve the Indian question. But Beltrami County is one of the poorest in the country. I think it's in the top five. All of the problems that go on up there, like, if you look at it from a real world, like, I'm not trying to be a dick perspective, so many of the problems emerge from poverty and isolation and things that could easily be controlled were the government at all interested in not facilitating suffering. The way the Nunahi are written, I never encountered a Dakota or a Ojibwe or a Cree or generally Anishinaabe writing of a Nunahi. But, like, the way they're written is just so very beneficial. Very, like, they have no actual, like, negative motivations whatsoever. And they're half-human. They're changelings. How do they not have access to the part of them that probably grew up in intense poverty, maybe grew up in an abusive situation? Like, these are things that happen to human beings. It's not necessarily a Native American thing. Like, why? Why are they written this way?
Well, I mean, to be honest, you know, I've gone back and looked at the books where the Nunahi have been included, and from talking to a few people that were somewhat involved, I got the feeling that the people that wrote the Nunahi cared about the material, but they were white writers. It's the details you just talked about, the poverty dynamics in Native American communities, telling a story about the chief impeachment related to corruption. I wouldn't tell that story. I could not tell that story well. And I think a lot of the Nunahi being kind of generally beneficial, there are some angry, intense, violent Nunahi characters in books, but by and large, they're all written from they're pissed off because oppression, and you totally get it, and it's understandable. They're not corrupt. They're not world of darkness dark. They're angry and violent, but through a fairly sympathetic lens, I would say, has been my experience of the more violent-edged Nunihi characters. I think it's because they've fundamentally been written by white writers. You know, and if I'm going to be honest, if they're going to be written by white writers, I would prefer what they are to if white writers had tried to dive into those darker manifestations, because down that road lies the Kuei-jin.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, I am coming at this from a, like, 20-0s, 20-teens, like, place where the internet exists, and, like, you can pick up a book, and you can read about minority experience, and it's not especially difficult. But at the same time, like, you know, even going into, you know, Kuei-jin Xian territory, there's a beautiful compilation book that's sitting on my shelf right now called Bamboo Amongst the Oaks, I think is what it's called. And it's all about the experience of Hmong Americans living in Minnesota. And there's this amazing short story in it about this man who, like, it's framed in semi-mystical terms, and I feel like I'm missing some of the context for where it's coming from, but it's totally a changeling story. Like, he is struggling against this thing that comes up from him in the night, and he calls it a tiger spirit, but I feel like I'm missing context there. But it's just this violent, angry impulse, and the way he describes it, like, it just emerges from this place that's partly, you know, the American minority experience, but also partly the experience of being an abused kid. And it's so relatable. And at the same time, like, I read that and I look at the Xian and I just go, where's this? Like, what happened to the Xian? Same thing with the Nunihi. Like, why is the human element missing? Why is the dark part of the mythology missing? And I think you're right that ideally, this is a topic that needs to be dealt with by writers with lived experience of these things. But I just feel like the Nunihi especially and the Xian, like, there's no room for that either.
Yeah, I feel like in C20, they tried to improve that representation by including... They didn't really make a change with the Hisien, because the Hisien are really not changelings in the changeling way, so they weren't going to do anything with the Thalane with them. But they added a Native American Thalane, and they added an Ahune Thalane. And if I'm going to be honest, I think that is a step in the right direction. I think it's a pretty small step, though, especially because in the case of the Huakipo and the Skinwalker, they're both super monstrous. Like, the Ghast, the Bogart, the Bogey, the Nasty, the Spriggan are all archetypes in our world. You know, the person who stalks the streets and is a serial murderer and kidnaps people is a thing in our world that exists. The really slimy, creepy, victimizing lawyer is a thing that exists in our world. The just, like, disgusting, corrupt, toxic tormentor that we meet when we're in college and we go down that, like, those 3 years we don't want to talk about is a thing that exists in our world. The Skinwalker and the, I think I'm pronouncing this correctly, the Huakipo are much more animist. They're much more dark things out in the darkness. And they don't really speak to that human lived experience and the dark end of that. They're just dark myths, which again, I think that has its place. I think if we had an array of Thalane for these groups, it would be fine having one or two of them like that. I sort of wish the Kithane had a little more of that. But when that's the only representation, you're still kind of missing out on the piece that you're talking about. Spitting out the last of that foul meat, now mingling in my mouth with minty fresh toothpaste. I hear a strange noise. I turn around and am horrified at the hideous thing before me. Only dogs have white teeth. A hulking creature of feline visage snarls in contempt. Its dark, blotchy fur reeks of bloody filth and waste, and it's taking my best effort to keep from vomiting at the sight of this abomination in my hallway. It stands hunched over at nearly 6 feet tall, with eyes like glittering opals. Its jagged, stained teeth barely fit into its gruesome maw. Its breath comes in a strange, ragged rhythm, and it grooms itself with a long, prehensile tongue. My master insists you give him an audience, storyteller. It hisses, reaching for me. I try to scream, but no sound comes out as I scramble away from its outstretched claw. My efforts to evade are futile. You are not dreaming. We have come. And you will tell the world what you have seen, storyteller. And if you please us, you may live to see the morning. Perhaps. The shadows have coalesced into the shape of a massive creature, an unholy hybrid of man and tiger, its muscles rippling with ferocious power and supernatural malevolence. Around me, I can feel the presence of hundreds of cruel eyes upon me, watching me, ready to tear me into a thousand scarlet shreds at a single command. My eyes turn towards the wall and the picture of my family, who gaze at me, impotently, powerless to help. Who are you? I stammer, trying not to sound like a fool. Who do you think I am, storyteller? The tiger creature rumbles in reply. I don't know. I say, flinching, as I see the rage flood into his eyes, pouring into those cold pupils like a pitcher of boiling blood. Clearly the wrong answer. I have walked with you and your ancestors for 4,000 years, before your kind could even keep time, he roars. I am the spirit you trembled in terror of for generations upon generations. It is to me that you fed the worst of your pitiful kind. I am he whose name you whispered fearfully to your children at night to make them behave. And now you do not recognize me? What insolence! What arrogance! This creature, man!
You're just a bit of badly digested beef, I cry out, shaking my head in denial. A massive roar silences me, as the seething demonic figure raises a massive hand in outrage, ready to strike me for the affront.
I am the Tiger King, storyteller. Do you dare not recognize me now? I have come 1,000,000 miles to tell you what I tell you tonight, to align the records properly and bring your kind a final gift from my dying court. You will mark these words exactly, or we shall tear you apart on the day of your greatest happiness. We owe you this much for 1,000 years of your fearful hearts.
Getting into something that, as two white guys, we should be able to talk about with a little bit more gravity than things we haven't lived and have only experienced by proxy. Changelings' inability to engage with Europe in a meaningful way.
Oh,
kind of
yeah.
Hinges on some of the same failings it has with the Nunahi and the Xian and the Ishu. What's going on with Europe?
So this is something I've been thinking a lot about recently. I was looking at Concordia when we were working on the history episode. And in looking at the whole Concordia history, which is honestly a lot richer and more interesting than I thought it was going to be. I don't tend to be a metaplot guy. I've learned a ton about the metaplot in Changeling for this podcast. The thing I realized is so many of the systems in Changeling, the base premise of the idea of commoners learning sovereign and what it means in navigating this hierarchical, well, what is your status system as a commoner? You know, being able to purchase title as a commoner, having holdings, those are all intrinsically wrapped up in David's Compromise and Concordia and the Parliament of Dreams and the agreement we have on this soil. What does any of that even mean in Europe? David's Compromise doesn't mean anything in Europe. At first I thought, well, none of that would be there. Then I stepped back and I thought, wait a second. All of that stuff is really actually a pretty elegant reflection of that American ethic I was talking about earlier. Well, in Europe, socialism took root much more. You know, you have the whole overt fight about whether or not the monarchy is still valid in the United Kingdoms. You also have some neoliberalism in the UK, but it's a totally different relationship. And then you have, you know, these areas just north of there in Ireland where it's like, no, we are our own country. And they have a completely different societal relationship that they're representing. And then you go up into Scotland where it's like, we have our own identity. We're technically still part of the UK. Are we staying part of the UK? Well, I don't know. What does the societal dream of the European Union represent? When I started thinking about what happened in Greece several years ago and the role Germany plays in all of that, and I thought about, okay, so Concordia was clearly designed, even though it's not always played up, it was designed to be a reflection of this whole American relationship with feudalism. When you think about the lived on our continent, World War I and World War II history, and the rise of socialism as a push against a lot of things, the fact that corporatocracy outside of the UK is much less developed in Europe, how is neo-feudalism relevant in Europe? And I'm not saying it's not. I actually think it is. But it would look so dramatically different. As an American, I can look at that and see that as a totally different beast. I cannot tell you how to represent it. Like, I can't even wrap my head around how I would reflect that in the what is the dream of through a mirror murky approach that Changeling takes.
I really liked the thing Neil Gaiman did towards the end, maybe in the epilogue of American Gods. Spoilers, it's an old book, you shouldn't be surprised by spoilers, but Shadow goes to Iceland, I think, and encounters another aspect of Wotan, and he's not as much of a dick as Mr. Wednesday is. I actually really, really like the idea that Faye, who stuck out the shattering and survived the long interregnum all the way up to the resurgence and weren't completely unmoored from their social context, from their traditional lands and their traditional people. You know, maybe they went through a lot. Maybe they went through more than the Fae that went to America did or other places. But maybe they're better adjusted. You know, they're not monsters. It's still the world of darkness. They're still kind of vaguely vampiric, but maybe it has developed into a slightly more commensal relationship and less outright parasitic.
Yeah, the other thing I've been thinking of that I kind of want to play with at some point in a story is, you know, there's the whole Nunahi-Cathayn comparison where the Cathayn feed on people and the Nunahi are connected to the land, and there's I've seen discussion about, you know, a desire to make the Nunahi more distinct, which is why musing wasn't included in the new edition. But the thing that I keep thinking is, what if it's not noble, savage, more spiritual, we're connected to the land? What if it's, no, the she back in Ireland are like that. The she here don't know that. They don't remember it. But when you're actually next to the mounds, and you're a fae of the mounds, and you're a spirit of the mounds, no, that's still who you are. And what makes the Cathayn in America the way they are is they had to find a way to survive disconnected from the land that birthed them. And it's not that these other fae are different, and they only gather from the land because colonialism. The trauma lives with the Cathayn in America. And all of these stories and all of these books about, oh, well, here's how Europe thinks about them, and they have this relationship with America, with Concordia. No, no, that's all. That's all story dreaming shenanigans. In reality, you go back to Europe, and you're dealing with fae living in the land that birthed them, and they still have that connection to the land. And maybe it's not, I don't like the as absolute as everyone, that's the only way you feed, but more of them, and fae that are traditionally thought of as feeding off of human dreams, still have this relationship. I think not wiping away the canon expectation that American fae have, keeping that expectation, but then having the reality not line up to it, has a ton of potential to say some really interesting things about what Changeling is trying to do socially.
Mm-hmm. And then on the other hand, there are canonical, like, descriptions of what kingdoms in Europe are like now after the resurgence that haven't been directly contradicted by C20 yet. The one I always found the most interesting was House Skaha is strongly tied to, maybe originally from, France. After the resurgence, I don't remember which book it was in, but in one of the books, they were talking about the outcome of the resurgence war in different places and how it shook out differently. And in France, Skaha came back, and they never really left, but the Arcadian Skaha came back and more or less reinforced the Autumn Skaha there. And France is implied to be a very traditional place that is extremely invested in she superiority and the commoner's proper place and blah, blah, blah. And looking at that and looking at what Skaha is in America is so unbelievably, interestingly contradictory. I want both of those things to be true, and they make no sense to be true at the same time, especially in the context of French history, because, oh my god, the French Revolution, you know?
Oh yeah, I mean, the idea, like, what would it mean to be a Skaha when Marie Antoinetted? Just contemplating that is kind of hard to parse.
But even relocating that story to Britain, say, which has a more American-ish, it is not America light. It only has themes in common. It's not the same place. But even then, like, compared to mainland Europe, it is a much more politically comprehensible place to my American mind. And I can see parallels there, and I could put that story there and not be quite as broken about the way history plays with that story. I mean, Margaret Thatcher.
I also think that, it's again, like, there are themes in common, and the similarities between the UK and America have more to do with the explicit political alliances and the way we have chosen to move together as cultures over the last couple centuries, as opposed to any sort of intrinsic natural similarity. But then when I think about Germany, when I think about Greece, when I think about Spain, you know, you start getting into other, even other Western European countries, and it gets less like America, especially when you get into places that would look at our Puritan work ethic and go, what? Why would you even? And that's kind of the crux of our version of neo-feudalism, is all about that work ethic and the working and building and working your way up the ladder, but you're not really going to do that, but you think you can. And that whole illusion in the story we're trapped in is our neo-feudalism. So, like, what is neo-feudalism in the countries where that's really not part of the ethic? And how do you engage with that if you want that cultural crossover in your game, if you're not from there? And then it gets even weirder if you get over into, like, Russia and Eastern Europe, and you get into experiences that honestly we have even less context for, because societally, in large part because of the Cold War, we have just not taken an objective look or been connected to that experience. And we have far more stereotypes than we have actual information about what it would mean to live in those places.
Dark, cold Russian nights that gave us the Slua.
Slua-shi. I'm just going to say it again. Slua-shi. I love that story. It's a great story. They're part of the Shi. We're done here.
I'm Cave Johnson. We are Slua here. When you think of the touchstones for the American cultural understanding of, say, Russia, say, our feudalism, like, the place that all comes together in kind of a affluent confluence is Ayn Rand. Because our feudal, feudal, air quotes, our feudal system, our managerial system, our corporate system, is all heavily tied to the American railroads. And at the same time, Ayn Rand wrote about railroads. She wrote about it from the perspective of her father's railroad being completely destroyed in Russia. But people read that and think it's an American story. And, oof. Like, she even comes out and says that she's kind of hoping for a feudal system. And I was always so disappointed that never came up anywhere in Changeling. Because I can't read about an American feudal thought and not think Ayn Rand.
I mean, that's incredibly valid. Which, you know, going back to, we only have stereotypes of, there is something to be said for a lot of our neo-feudalism is less about an identity we built for ourselves and more an abject rejection of at least what we thought Russian identity was, or communist identity.
Yeah, that
I'm not going to go out on a limb and say how much of that it was really accurate in terms of that, but what we thought, and then we rejected it and reacted against it, which, again, Ayn Rand, that is 100% Ayn Rand.
It is so weird watching the news now and hearing about the Russian oligarchy and thinking, yeah, that's terrible. That sounds just awful. And then looking at our cable companies, for example.
Yeah, it's very weird. And it also brings to mind, you know, something that doesn't get touched on a lot with Changeling, but the pieces are there. So we have Concordia. We have this big place and a land that was transformed by this Gwydion Shi's dream, and he was able to transform this huge land. And then you go back and you think about source myths and you're like, man, okay, so Varric had these tiny little countries. I mean, the Irish myths had this island. There is no previous context in the canon for the scope of a fae having influence over that large an area, because it isn't even just America. Concordia includes a good, maybe all of Canada, most of Canada. There's no context for that at all. And I think there's an interesting statement to be made there if you get into globalism. So, like, okay, well, let's do the whole King David Falls thing, but now we have this rapidly expanding globalist thing. What if what replaces Concordia isn't so culturally specific? What if the Fae, in their eternal endeavor to transform into something that can exist in this more toxic new world, transforms into something that could do a dream much larger than Concordia? And what does that little piece of oppression look like? Because I think that lines up with the world we're finding ourselves in.
Oh, man. All those hours I spent reading conspiracy theories about NAFTA suddenly became relevant in that moment.
I mean, yeah. The Fae and the technocracy. I'm telling you, they're cooperating. Let me go get my aluminum hat.
The ocean mist rises up like breath. The water crashes against the Irish shore. It's like that brackish spray is rolling up right out of the Valley of Mists. Being here, some part of me remembers that smell.
the brine frothing up into the air. It's somehow different from the smell of the bay back home. Oh, back home. Was San Francisco home? The fog that shrouds so much of the bay always whispers about older dreams than you or I, and here, where I should be the older dream, I miss you, my lady, and I miss Concordia, but I miss here as well. There's an emptiness in me standing here on this mound, this she. I dreamt last night of a great battle with the Malaysians, here on this shore, fighting alongside the rest of the Shining Host in grandeur and glory, unlike anything I've ever glimpsed in my memories of Arcadia, but we still lost. The sons of Adam and the daughters of Eve came in such numbers, and when they were done, we became small. I thought perhaps I was glimpsing the moment when we slid into humans. Seeing the beginning of the changeling way I undertook all those generations ago, but we didn't slide into mortals. We slid into the mound, became the earth, and it felt so good, so... I don't know. It felt like my memories of Chris's mother before, well, before Chrysalis and leaving home. When I woke up, one of the local nobles was standing over me, smiling. Her finery was made of vines and moss, but she was family? We talked for a while, and I swear I could feel the glow of epiphany on her, but she had no dreamer with her, and our conversation, I mean, we always speak in riddles, even to each other, but no matter how much it should have felt like I was with Kin, it's like I was Ghislaine. I can't stop thinking about that dream. The embrace of the earth by the sea. The regent is sending me to Japan when I get home. I'll barely be able to enjoy the bay at all. I'll barely be able to see you. He says Concordia isn't enough, that the dream of the king must be larger than David's provincial vision. If I'm not truly home here, if my oldest dreams are of an embrace even the bay does not offer me when I return to her, then what will Japan give me? I am alone without my home, and I'm not even sure what home is. I would certainly know where you are not, my lady. Without you, I may as well be lost in the mist of the great highway. Yet I fear that is where I will dwell for some time.
Tying the Fae more strongly into the World of Darkness narrative, like, it has its pitfalls too, because... You know, we talk about Changeling doing Europe badly, Changeling doing the Native Americans badly, Changeling doing Yishu badly. World of Darkness also has those flaws. It's very West-specific and White-West, probably American-specific. And parts of it do better than others, but even trying to place Changeling a little bit more into the World of Darkness world... Like, you're only going to get so far with that.
Yeah, it's true. And there is also the question of how do you even tell that story? That idea of, okay, Concordia fell. Now there's this bigger kingdom because we're going to make a commentary on globalism. You know, I would not want to tell that story at the globalist level. I would want to tell that story from the point of view of a small motley living locally, having to live through the reshaping. You know, it's always kind of implied that, oh, the land became High King David's dream. And, you know, they dance around this. We were all transformed by his dream because ultimately Caliburn picked him. I've always read it as Caliburn picked him because he had the force of fey magic slash will to craft a kingdom that large, a swath of the dreaming that came together in a coherent dream. But it's never really talked about, like, what was it like being a fey that then had to become a different story than they were before? Like, it had to have happened, but it's not dealt with. And I think the idea of that globalist story and the much bigger kingdom, I don't even know that I'd want to tie it that much more deeply into the world of darkness, world of darkness. But I think it would be really interesting to start a story in the normal world of darkness, normal changeling canon, move into the fall of Concordia and the rise of a much larger kingdom that maybe included Europe and whatnot, and all the fae being super confused about what the heck was happening and actually having to live through that reshaping. I think that's the way you would do that and tell a story about the anxiety people feel about globalization.
We've always been at war with East Asia.
Yeah, let's really bring the Hisien into this story, see how that goes.
Yeah, but especially with the way Changeling is set up with the canon post-C20, probably moving into the parallel LARP canon a little bit, the figure who can replace David is never named, but I did really enjoy the conversation we had with the LARP team and how Milgi and Trump are basically the same person was, like, kind of the theme. Because...
yeah.
Like, David is written as being such a good guy. Like, he's a white guy trying to be a good guy, which is sometimes all you can hope for, but he's trying to be a good guy. Milgi is not. And you just have, over and over and over again, this thing that happens in history where, like, there's a swing towards, I guess I'm going to use the word, like, justice, but it's so loaded that it's hard to use it that way. But, like, social equality and a more equitable social contract that gets followed by the erosion of everything that could have possibly been. And, like, I just see, like, the next couple of moves in the game that is the Changeling meta plot being ripping everything David wanted apart. And
yeah,
Milgi's
I mean,
the person to do that.
Yeah, but I think that's the next step in both meta plots. Like, honestly, it's pretty clear in C20, okay, we somehow dragged David out of this iron cage before he was undone, but he is not the shining host bastion of mists and will that Caliburn picked to be High King.
I mean, Caliburn isn't even mentioned.
Yeah.
Also,
I really want
really,
that
really
to
weird.
Be intentional.
Yeah. It is really, really weird that Caliburn is in America, because Caliburn is another name for Excalibur. What the fuck is Excalibur doing in America?
Yeah, that is a question indeed. So that's really as good a point as any to sort of wrap up on the idea of social satire, commentary, and Changeling, and the places where we think you can do it. We've certainly been a little bit more upfront and honest about our critiques in this episode than we normally are. But I also hope that some of our ideas are things that, you know, you might be able to take and twist around and use somehow in your games, and that we've given you something to think about. As always, I'd like to thank my co-host, Simon, for doing this with me and everyone for listening. And I hope that you join us again for our next conversation on Walking Away from Arcadia. We'll be right back.
The readings from this conversation were from The Little Country by Charles DeLint, The True Tale of Yur by Brian Thawara, and Wistful She Nonsense by Victor Kinzer. The music from this episode was LSD by Mon Plaisir.